Thank you, Mr. Swank. Say one more greetings. Welcome to everybody. If you're just joining us, welcome to UCG Indy. I put together a little bit of a slideshow today to go along with this. So a couple weeks ago, we kicked off going through the churches of Revelation. We started with Ephesus. And I did a little bit of background, then we went through Revelation chapter 2, covering Ephesus. Today, we are going to shift on. I told you I'm going to mix them in over the next couple of months, or maybe throughout this next year, and try, hopefully by the end of the year, be all the way through all seven messages to the churches in Revelation. And so today, we're going to get to Smyrna. And Smyrna was a beautiful city. We can look back over hundreds of years and find ancient writings about Smyrna, and it's mentioning its beauty, this elegance that it had, and what it held as far as buildings, architecture, this natural harbor. So you can see it's very similarly placed with Ephesus. It's a little bit farther north, but it almost has this little cove. So it's got this natural harbor that even Ephesus doesn't. And so we find that this beautiful place with this superb harbor just makes this little city elegant. I say little, but I don't know exactly how comparative it was to everything else around. But it became this mecca for trade, just like Ephesus. Any of these little harbor cities, they tended to do well because of all this traffic back and forth. They became these big trade routes. And so we find this the same thing here. And along with the trade, they had this huge culture. They had music, they had theater, and this world trade hub. And so it became a city that flourished. It was extremely, extremely wealthy. They did very well for themselves. There was a lot of wealth that was going on in Smyrna. It was a very, very old city. And with that comes a lot of history. You know, we can see that that may have contributed to how wealthy they actually became. You see these generation after generation along this trade route. There's some historians that look back over time and approximate that they think Smyrna was established somewhere around 1000 BC. And for us, when we think about that, 1000 BC, that would make this city four times older at the time that this was written than we are today as the United States of America. Four times older. And that was that point in time that John actually writes this. So they have this long, long history of culture and establishing themselves there. Generation after generation expanding on all of this. Nelson's Illustrated Bible Dictionary actually states that Smyrna actually called themselves the first city of Asia. And it's because, they think it's because Smyrna actually caught on to something ahead of their time. They noticed something that was coming into play, and so they started adapting. They started recognizing what was going on in the world around them, and they were ahead of the game that the rest of the world didn't catch on to quite as quickly. And they believe this happened as early as 195 BC. And what they caught on to, what they foresaw, was that the rising power of the Roman Empire was going to be in charge. And along with that, it put them in a very good position to be able to continue to flourish in the capacity that they had been. And so they started building these Roman temples of worship. They got ahead of it, said, okay, we see that this society is going to be in charge, so we're going to do what we can to buffer ourselves and actually put ourselves out in front of this. And so they started building these temples for Roman worship. And they declared themselves an ally of Rome. And they wanted to establish that relationship and say, hey, we're here in this with you. We're going to work together. We don't want to buck your system. Treat us good. And so what ended up happening in 23 BC, Smyrna was given an honor that nobody else was given. They were given the honor to build the Temple of Tiberius. And a lot of these Caesars at this time, they had multiple temples all over the areas. The Temple of Tiberius, there was only one temple to Tiberius, the ruler of Tiberius, and it was placed here in Smyrna. And so it became this center for cult worship, became the center for emperor worship, and because of that, Smyrna results in hundreds of years as a loyal partner to Rome, to the Roman Empire. They were loyal to the city, to Rome itself. And today, we know this as modern Izmir, which is a big city. It's one of the strongest cities in Turkey at this point in time. I did a quick search. It looks like it's in one of the top three when people are looking to go to Turkey they say you need to get to this place. So we see here with Smyrna that they were prosperous. They had a lot of culture, a lot of activities, a lot of things were going on. And they had an unusually high number of Jews. And just kind of keep that in the back of your mind, because I'll readdress this a little bit later, and it'll kind of play into a little bit of what happens to the members in Smyrna and what they're dealing with. And so I titled my sermon today, Smyrna, Handling Tribulation. Smyrna, Handling Tribulation. And what we find here is going to be interesting with what the Smyrnan church went through and what they have to deal with. Before we get into Revelation, I want to go through a couple of things that kind of lays the foundation of why we may see that they were persecuted on such a level. In William Barclay, he's a Scottish commentator who wrote in one of his volumes the six slanders of why the church in Smyrna could have been persecuted. So he gives these ideas of, okay, this may be what leads people to persecute this church so heavily. And I want to go through those because it kind of lays this foundation of what we believe and how it can be misconstrued extremely easily when you want to manipulate what's going on. Number one, it was that because of Passover, they called Christians cannibals. Because of the Passover, they were supposedly eating the body and the blood of Jesus Christ. And so anytime you eat body or blood, you become a cannibal. And so they used that against them. Another one would have been, number two, would have been that they called used agape, that agape love for the feasts, these feasts that they have, and they called them the love feasts. And so society said that they have these massive orgies, and they do all of this disgusting stuff, and they get lumped into this negative connotation of these orgy lusts. Number three was that Christianity split up families. And at that time, not everybody was called, and sometimes it did split these families from the standpoint that if one person's called, they ended up trying to change who they were. They didn't keep continuing to go to these Roman temples and worshiping false gods. They didn't take their children up to pay homage to the emperors or false gods. And so they see that this division in these families started taking place if only one of a married couple was called. And conversion's difficult. There's a lot of changes that take place, especially in situations like this, where God's Spirit has to fully guide us to make changes in our lives, to make strides so that we make improvements on how we act and what we say and what we do. On our own, we don't have the strength or power to do that. It's through God's assistance that He does that, and it's with His Holy Spirit. And so if we think about Smyrna at this time, what they were dealing with, what they were going through with this, Rome was actually very open when it came to religions. There was a lot of religious freedoms. And so they had an issue because they couldn't figure out why the Christians just couldn't keep their mouth shut. They couldn't worship their own stuff and leave everybody else alone. And this will actually play into something we talk about a little bit later too. And so they start viewing this and realize, just to give you a little back history, so the Roman law was actually so receptive that you couldn't take a Jew to court on the Sabbath. They were so understanding of other religions that they knew the Jews wouldn't be able to do that. So they made a law. There was a Roman law that wouldn't allow you to take a Jew to court because they knew that the Jews wouldn't appear, that they were breaking their law with God, and so they wouldn't do that. And so they have this understanding and this protection of freedom of religion, but it just didn't make sense with what the Christians were doing. They couldn't figure out why that they couldn't just believe what they believed. Because for the Romans, the Roman thought was, okay, if we're worshiping all the gods, nobody's going to be mad at us. We worship everybody and everything, and we'll be blessed by something. Somebody or something will bless us. And so that was this idea that the Romans had, that, okay, we'll just cover everything. We'll cover every base that we have, and then we don't have to worry about it. And so with the Christians, it was a little different because they wouldn't go and do these things. And so they started seeing this division. And it happened within the families. And so that was number three. Number four is they were accused of being atheists. again, from the Roman standpoint, they're viewing these Christians and they're thinking, okay, you come in, you do away with all of the gods except for Yahweh. And so you have this one God that you now say, but you get kicked out from the Jews. The Jews no longer like you. They say that you don't believe in Yahweh. And so that leaves you with no gods. Now you come up and you say you have this Jesus Christ who is alive when we know we killed him. He doesn't exist. And so they start boiling all of this down and say, well, you guys are atheists. You have no gods. There's nothing, there's no God that you have left. And to compound on top of this, Christians at that time, they didn't have idols, right? They didn't have figures. They didn't have statues. And to that world, if you didn't have a symbol of your God, you didn't have a God. And so they can play all of this together and they lump this in and say that Christians were atheists. And point number five, this slander number five, they were accused of being politically disloyal. Again, at this time, emperor worship was a very real thing. It was prominent in this time. They were viewed as gods. The problem is that Christians didn't view the Caesars as lords or gods, and so they wouldn't pray to them. They would pray for them. We're in the same boat today, right? We pray for those in positions of power. We pray for the President of the United States. We pray for those who are running countries around the world that it's peaceful, and that they work together. And they would do that, but they just wouldn't pray to Caesar. And so they were disloyal politically. And then the sixth slander. Christians are arsonists or pyromaniacs. And this comes from that idea that at the end of the world, everything's going to burn. Christians talked about the entire world burning, this end time result of what's going to happen and take place. And so along with this, what we find is that there were Caesars that at certain points in history took advantage of this. Nero was a guy who liked to build. He liked to construct things. It was something about his nature. He just liked to build things. Well, the problem is everything was built. There wasn't much space to do anything else. And so one of the ways that he manipulated this idea and this thought was that they burned the city, that the city was burnt. And then he was able to blame it on the Christians, say, the Christians caused this. They said everything was going to burn. They said this was going to happen. And so he used that to his advantage, that the city would burn. He burned it, and he just blamed the Christians for it. And so these Christians in Smyrna are dealing with all of these slanders, these ideas that normal people have about what it is to be a Christian. And so this kind of puts that some of the stigma into Christianity being bad or being a problem. They stir up trouble. And it's interesting because there's not much information about the church in Smyrna. Now, we can look throughout the Bible and we basically have these four verses in Revelation that talks about Smyrna and what's going on here. Before we jump over to Revelation, though, I'd want to turn to a couple places just to remind us that this isn't uncommon. This isn't new, going through persecution or tribulation. This is something that we are all going to experience if we haven't already experienced it, and we're going to continue to go through it. So if you flip over to 2 Timothy with me, take a look at 2 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 12. I want to look at this one and a couple other ones. And you know, unfortunately, as Christians, we know that we are going to deal with difficulties in life. It's not always going to be peaceful. It's not always going to be pleasant. God talks about persecution and endurance. You know, we are running the race. We each have an individual race that we're working through. And God gives us multiple warnings to remind us that we have to keep actively working, with striving to do better and overcoming. And this fits perfectly with what we're dealing with today in society. It's probably going to fit even closer as we get closer to the end time of what we're going to deal with. But here in 2 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 12, he says, yes, and all who desire to live godly in Christ Jesus will suffer persecution. He doesn't say, you might. There's a chance. A few of you, he says, you will suffer persecution. So we all have to be prepared for that. You don't have to turn these other two. I put them in the slide with me, but you can note them if you'd like for a study later. First one, Psalm 34:19 says, many are the afflictions of the righteous, but the Lord delivers him out of them all. That's a That gives us a little bit to bolster from at the end of that, right? He doesn't just say, well, that you're going to be persecuted, deal with it. He says, the Lord delivers him out of them all. He's our safety net. He's our protector, our provider. Doesn't mean he's going to remove the difficult situations, but he's always there to help. And this is actually, John 16:33 is one of my favorite scriptures of all time. It helps me to keep that reality check of what life really is. And it says, these things I have spoken to you, that in me you may have peace. In the world you will have tribulation, but be of good cheer. I have overcome the world. I just love that. Because that tells us we have nothing to worry about. There is nothing that we have to get upset about, get worried about. He specifically says, be of good cheer. In the world you will have tribulation, but be of good cheer. And he doesn't say that from the sense of, okay, deal with it, move along, move on, it's not that bad. But it's in the sense that we know we have victory. God is victorious. He doesn't just say, deal with it. What he's telling us is, he goes, I've already won, and therefore you have already won. If you live this life, you are a winner with me. Satan can't do anything else. There's no way that this plan changes unless we reject that. It might be difficult. He says it will be difficult at times. And so that's the reassuring part. Even though we know there will be tribulation, there will be difficulties, persecution, we always know that we win. That's why I think he tells us, be of good cheer. You don't have anything to be upset about. You don't have anything to be sad about. Because you have eternity. You have a life in the God family if you follow my path. And that's the exciting part. So now, if you would, we'll go ahead and jump back to Revelation chapter 2 and verse 8. This is where we get into the next message to the seven churches, the church here at Smyrna. We left off with verse 8. If you remember from my opening comments when we started last time, Smyrna was one of those churches that didn't receive any punishment. They didn't receive any corrections. There were no threats to this church. So let's jump in here in Revelation chapter 2 and verse 8. He says, and to the angel of the church in Smyrna write, these things says the first and the last who was dead and came to life. We think about what this is meaning, who this is pertaining to. Jesus Christ set a perfect example of this, of he died, but that's not the first or the last. He didn't end with that. He came back to life. Now, this doesn't mean that his spirit was running around doing whatever it wanted to at that point in time. He was physically dead. There was a group of people that didn't believe that Jesus Christ was flesh and blood. We understand that he was. He was created just as we are created, as a human being, as flesh and blood. And he died. And at that point, as a physical body laying there, there was a period of time where he was dead. He didn't exist. God's spirit still existed. God's spirit can't be destroyed. Just as when he gives us his spirit, there's something that God does that keeps that. But as a physical body, he died. And he was resurrected. He was begotten as a child of God, in the similar sense that we will. He had to wait that time period after he was buried for God to resurrect him, bring him back to life, so that he could rejoin the Godhead, rejoin the God family. And so he says, who was dead and came to life. Now there's another speculation to what Christ was intending here. It's something that we mentioned earlier, that I briefly referenced to earlier, of what the society is doing here. But if you can remember, I talked about how quickly Smyrna was to jump onto the Caesar train, the emperor worship, to recognize that the Roman Empire was going to be in control. So they tagged along with this emperor worship. And so here we're blatantly seeing this bashing of this idea of emperor worship, because it was thought that when Caesars died, their spirit went up into the atmosphere and they became stars and they existed there, and people could continue to worship them, continue to praise them up in the sky. And so they would be worshipped. People would still continue to come to these temples designated solely for these different Caesars. As I mentioned, Tiberius was only one, and it was here in Smyrna. And so this statement that's being made is in direct opposition of this thought here in the city of Smyrna. What is a focal point? If we think about them jumping on to that, that trend of the Roman Empire and Caesar worship. They were at the forefront of that line saying, hey, we understand what you need us to do. We'll do it. So he's bashing that. He's saying this isn't how this works. Jesus Christ is the only one that has gone through this process. And so now we get to verse 9. And verse 9 says, I know your works, tribulation, and poverty. Now that doesn't necessarily sound like a life that we want to live, is it? That's not at the forefront of our thought process of, okay, I want to do all these works. I want to work hard. I want to respect your way of life, God. I want to do things for you. I want to go through poverty. I don't want to have much. I want to go through tribulation. I want to suffer for all of this good stuff that I'm doing. And I don't have anything to show for it. That doesn't come to my mind. That's not the mindset that I have. And sometimes we can slip into thinking, okay, well, maybe there was something wrong with this church. Maybe these people, they did something that they deserved this. That there was something that happened, either their attitudes or their characters, something that they broke of God's law where they deserved this. They didn't deserve God's blessings, but they needed this punishment. But that's not the case. That's not what we find in Jesus Christ's letter, in the message that Jesus Christ presents to the church here. If you notice what he says right after that, it gives us a hint at what they were on the right track. They were doing the right thing. He says, I know your works, tribulation, and poverty, but you are rich. But you are rich. They didn't need the physical things. You know, that there's zero condemnation. There's zero correction. He's not telling them how to do it right. This congregation here in Smyrna, they were doing the works. They were going through exactly what they were supposed to be. And they were being persecuted for it. They were going through poverty. They weren't whining about it. They weren't crying about it. The Greek here, it's for us, when we read it, it says poverty. But the Greek actually means they were destitute. They had nothing. They were utterly destitute. When we think about that, they probably struggled from day to day to find meals. They probably didn't have homes. If we correlate that to what we understand as utterly destitute, they had nothing. They had no reliance on normalcy they had nothing dependable that they could count on for meals and safety, protection from weather. These people were in poverty. They were homeless. And it wasn't for anything they did. They were doing works. They were pursuing a life that God wanted. They were preaching the gospel. For me, I think about the Beatitudes and what it means to us of how we change our character. And it talks about, blessed is the poor in spirit. And I think sometimes it's hard because we don't want to go through the poverty or the tribulation. But at the same time, it's really hard for us to look up and be thankful when we're sitting on top. When we're riding high, doing good, doing well, we don't tend to look up at times. And so God has to bring us really low. Really low, so that then we do look up. But that's not what happened here at Smyrna. He doesn't say any of that. There's no correction. He just says, you did works. You did these things. And so we need to be really aware of this when we think about how we're acting, what we're doing in our lives. So let's finish out verse 9. It says, I know your works, tribulation, and poverty, but you are rich. And I know the blasphemy of those who say they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. Yeah, this is another area where commentators have different views and different ideas of what is actually being meant here. Because the Jews, the persecution that the Jews went through, nobody just willingly wants to go through that. It's not, hey, pick me. I want to persecute me. That's not what we do. We don't hop on that train of being persecuted. We generally don't voluntarily jump into those situations. Now, at times we kind of push ourselves into them and we find ourselves stuck in something. But for the most, we don't do it knowingly or on purpose. That's not what it was. So when we think about this, the explanation that probably makes the most sense is that these were physical Jews. You know, early on I talked about there was an unusually high population of Jews in this area. It kind of goes hand in hand with this because as we look through the book of Acts and the reasoning of why they would talk about this, you know, much of the persecution that the Christians faced, it was actually boiled back down to the Jews. It was carried out by pagans, but it originated by the Jews. The Jews were upset. The Jews had rejected Jesus Christ as the Messiah. And so they knew that the Christians had that completely wrong. And on top of that, the Christians, they were pulling in Jews and proselytes. Those were the first Christians. Most of the first Christians were either Jews or proselytes. People that the Jews had converted to Judaism. And so they spent all of this time, all of this hard work as Jews converting people. Then this new sect of Judaism, Christianity, starts pulling away members. So they were upset. They were upset about this. Not only were they pulling them to this new sect, but they were claiming that Jesus Christ was the Messiah. So they were upset. They didn't like it. And so the Jews actually perpetuated a lot of this persecution that they faced, that the Christians faced. If you would, flip back to Romans chapter 2 with me. When we think about conversion and how God is working with people, who God is working with, we see this in a couple of different lights. Because Paul's dealing with Jews and Gentiles, and so we need to really understand how we're supposed to relate to this. I brought this up in the last sermon that I gave, talking about why only baptized members take the Passover. We touched on this, not quite this whole... We did more than of what this is. But if you look at Romans chapter 2, we're going to pick it up in verse 27. He says, "And will not the physically uncircumcised be counted as circumcision? And will not the physically uncircumcised, if he fulfills the law, judge you who even with your written code and circumcision are a transgressor of the law?" In verse 28, it says, "For he is not a Jew who is one outwardly, nor is circumcision that which is outward in the flesh. But he is a Jew who is one inwardly, and circumcision is that of the heart, in the spirit, not in the letter, who praise is not from men, but from God." So we understand that we can be called today because God has opened a door to the Gentiles. We have an opportunity today because God understood that the Israelite nations, that they weren't able to uphold the example that he wanted at that point in time. So he opens this process to Jews and Gentiles. And he tells us that this physical circumcision, the physical outward appearance that was supposed to be that covenant between God and his people, is no longer the case for us. Under the new covenant, it is baptism, where we receive God's Spirit, and we actually change our heart. We are a different person on the inside, and ultimately portray that on the outside, by treating people differently, by acting differently. And so it's not an inward appearance that we have. We are spiritual Israelites because we are changing our hearts. Because we're changing how we act, how we interact with people in the world. We're not condemning people. We try to lead them to what's right. We never have an opportunity to condemn people. We're never given that job or that responsibility. Now, to shed some light on sinful areas, we are supposed to do that at times, in a loving, compassionate manner. And that's the very difficult part. But we have this opportunity because of God's willingness, because of God's grace and mercy. So we find this area talking about these people who seemed like they wanted to be close to the church, they wanted to be in the church, part of the church, but they weren't really in the church. They didn't get it. They didn't take it to heart. I don't know if there were benefits of being Christians. It sounds like they were just primarily persecuted. But there are some groups that kind of attached themselves to Christianity, and they wanted to be here. We've seen people come and go at times. Today, still, they like to be here. They like the potlucks. They do this and that, and then all of a sudden they fade away. They're not here any longer. We don't know why. We don't know what God's doing, what's changed in lives. But we have to do our best to be prepared to receive, to welcome, open arms, show love and compassion. This is a family that God's building, and we are supposed to continue to help people, to stay on the right path. So let's jump back to Revelation again. Revelation chapter 2. Verse 10, this is another statement that has created some difference of opinions, different ideas throughout the years. It's been searched over for years to try to figure out the exact meaning. Revelation chapter 2 and verse 10, it says, "Do not fear any of those things which you are about to suffer." Still, that's not more good news. These people who are already suffering, this is what he says. He says, don't fear any of the things you're about to suffer. When you have nothing, when you don't know where your next meal's coming from, you got to be going, all right, how much more can I suffer? All right, bring it on. He says, indeed, the devil is about to throw some of you into prison that you may be tested, and you will have tribulation 10 days. Be faithful until death, and I will give you the crown of life. So historians have a couple different views of what this actually means. He says these 10 days, he tells the church here at Smyrna, you have 10 days that you're going to be persecuted even more. You're going to go through some more trials, more difficulties. Some feel that this was actually a 10-year period. It wasn't a physical 10-day. We know by other prophetic events, so you can write down Ezekiel chapter 4 and verse 6, there's at times where prophecy, one day counts as a year. And so it's not a far-fetched idea that this may have been 10 years of persecution, especially as they've looked through history. I mean, when we look at Smyrna, they went through almost 200 years of persecution. They have years that they were going persecution. But at one period of time, it looks like there was such a high level of persecution that some historians think this took place between 303 to 313 AD. And this was a time when there was persecution under Diocletian. He just hated everything about Christianity, and he just made them miserable, destroying many of them. And so they look through and say, you know, this looks like the worst period of time for the Christians in this period of where they were living. This could easily be that 10-year period that he was talking about. We just don't know. We don't claim to know to have it pinpointed exactly what that means. But we do know that persecution came on them, and we do know that persecution is going to come on us someday. How much, how long, we're not exactly sure. But there's a point in time where thankfully, and this kind of goes into why historians think right here at the end of 313 that this is talking about, there was a edict of toleration, or the edict of Milan, that Constantine passed. And this was finally a period that gave Christians equal status with religion. They had religious freedom again, and they wouldn't be persecuted based on their religion, which comes after that 10-year period, which looks just horrendous to be a Christian, to live in that time period. There's something else along this way. I mentioned 200-some years of this time period of persecution. I thought I'd throw in. There's approximately 155 AD where Polycarp, he was a bishop, he was a famous bishop who stood up against the Roman bishop. They didn't agree on some of the things that was taking place. One of it was whether they should do Passover on the 14th or Easter. There was another idea that he would not bow down to the Caesars as Lord. He just refused to view Caesars as gods. He wouldn't worship them. And therefore, he was prone to be killed. He was set up to be killed. There's a couple different legends that go along with this, which are interesting. If you ever read it, there's some funny stories talking about it. One of them is that they set him up to be burned to death. They couldn't get the fire started at all, so they ended up just stabbing him. Another one takes it to an extreme, which is closer to what this depiction is. They actually were able to get the fire started, and it created the flames a type of tent. Probably more so, if you think of a ship with a big sail, the wind blowing in it, how it kind of tents out one direction. Legend is that it just made a tent around him. It puffed up, never burned him. So what they ended up doing, instead of burning him, since they couldn't do that, they just stabbed him. Where they stabbed him, a dove flew out. He bled so profusely that it actually put the fire out. There's a lot of folklore that goes along with what Polycarp went through. It's interesting to read. There's a point where people say they heard a voice. They think it was a voice from God talking to him, telling him to be strong, basically, and fight against the man at this point in time. Interesting stuff. Don't know how true it is. Someday we can ask God. But this is the type of stuff they went through. This was some of the struggles that they went through of being a Christian. of having a religion that you believed in that you really couldn't believe in. There was a chance that you would lose your life. Now, it was thought that Polycarp was actually taught by the Apostle John, and he very likely could have been the last surviving person to have firsthand interactions with an apostle. It's just theory that some have as far as timing goes. But it's interesting how some of this plays out and with what Smyrna was going through, what Christians experienced during this point in time. And so we have this 10 days, whatever that means. Like I said, we don't have a definitive answer of what that period is, what it actually entails. But the most important thing is that he tells them here, he says, be faithful. Christ is telling him, he says, be faithful. And the persecution isn't coming from God, it's coming from Satan and it's coming from man. He goes, you're going to be tested. You're going to have your limits pushed, but be faithful. He says, because if you're faithful until death, I will give you the crown of life. It goes back to that victory again, right? We win. No matter what happens in the physical life, what we have to go through, what we deal with, the physical life is temporary. On every sense of the word, physical. It's not going to last forever, whether it's death or whether it's the return of Jesus Christ. We know there's a finite amount of time that we will be physical. And he says, hold strong. Keep gripping on. He says, hang on. Don't get succumbed to this, the tired. Don't become tired. Don't become weak. He says, keep hanging on. When we think about this, we understand this. At times we are tired. We're worn down. We don't feel like we have much room for growth because all we're doing is just clutching on to what we've learned at this point. We're just hanging on for every bit of dear life of trying to survive. Because life is brutal at times. It can be brutal. And all of our energy is being poured out to just sustain life. Make sure our kids don't die. Make sure we're carrying on, living like we're supposed to. And we're just clutching on to where we're at, trying not to backslide at all. And so we have to hang on. You know, we can think about this perspective from tug of war. I would imagine just about everybody has either played tug of war at some point in time in your life, or you've watched some kids play tug of war at some point in time in your life. And from this stance of, you know, as this rope is shifting back and forth, as you're trying to pull the other team across, there gets a point where your legs are tired, your arms are tired, and you can't catch your breath. And if you're coordinated enough, if the team, if you can all pull back, extend your legs out, extend your arms out, dig your heels in, you just hang on. You're doing your best not to give up any ground. That flag stays in one spot and you're just hanging on. You're not pulling at all. You're just holding. And that's what I think of when we see this. We talk about these struggles and this persecution that they were going through. And when it gets rough, when life is difficult, we just hang on to what we've had. Hang on to what we've got at this point in time. If we can let our lungs recover, our legs finally quit burning, our arms quit burning, and then as a team, you start moving again. You start pulling as hard as you can after that little bit of recovery. That's what Christianity is. It's this ebb and flow of us doing really good, plateauing, doing our best not to backslide, having growth and improvement. And it's this constant cycle through this physical life, this training period that God has given to us. God's expectations are is that we succeed and we grow in this physical life. He wants to see growth. Then we get down to verse 11 here. Now, this is that infamous statement that we see in all seven letters, at least the first part of this. He says, he who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. And so again, this is said in all seven letters. So we know this is for everyone. This isn't specific churches. This is for all of us. All Christians who have ever lived and ever will live, we need to have an ear to listen to this and pay attention. Now the second part varies a little bit from church to church. He says, he who overcomes shall not be hurt by the second death. And so in this he's saying, you know, there is still expectations of personal growth. This doesn't mean you can become stagnant. You've done well so far. It doesn't mean you can stop. It doesn't mean you can settle in where you are and say, you know, I've done good enough. The church here at Smyrna, they continued to overcome. They continued to fight against everything that was ungodly. And they were persecuted and there was tribulation and they had nothing. They were stricken with poverty because of it. And Jesus Christ doesn't condemn them. He doesn't condemn anything that they've done. He just tells them, he says, you need to continue to have personal growth. He says, keep doing what you're doing. Stay on that path, because he who overcomes shall not be hurt by the second death. That destruction of a physical human being that rejects the way of God, that rejects being part of the family of God. He says, you can do it. You can do it. As that kind of wraps up here for Smyrna, what we're talking about. But I want to look at a couple different things before we wrap up here, take the next 10, 15 minutes, and look at a couple of examples that Paul leaves for us. If you head over to Acts chapter 9 and verse 20, I want to use some of these examples that Paul shows us, because it's very similar to understanding what persecution is when we see the examples that Paul went through, you know, of what he faced, the different experiences that he had with persecution, the troubles that he faced. Because for us, we're dealing with a different society. We're facing an increasingly secular humanistic society. And what secular humanism is, it's the belief that any religion that tries to enforce this supernatural concept on other people, anything that's religious, it's just wrong. That's a detriment to society if you're trying to push this onto other people. And that's what this idea is that we find floating in society today. And it kind of goes back, if we think about what Rome was doing, they didn't like it when Christians pushed their ideas. They called them family splitters. Here, today, we kind of have that same theme, that same idea. Authorities don't like it, the government doesn't like it, when we have these different ideas or different thoughts away from secular humanism. It's a detriment to society. But we have to think, what's our mission? What is the mission, our mission statement? Where we shall preach the gospel of Jesus Christ and the kingdom of God in all the world. We're going to make disciples in all nations, and we're going to care for those disciples. That doesn't mean we put our head down, we close up our doors and windows, and we worship God the way we're supposed to. We try to teach people. We try to help them. We help them in this life that they have. We try to show them, through spreading the gospel, of what God's expectations are and how he plans on working with them at some time in the future. And so we may someday end up finding ourselves in difficult situations, because we don't just shut our mouths. We don't just shut our mouths and leave everybody else alone. We have TV programs, we have magazines, we have booklets, we have our own voices. We have our own interactions that we deal with people. And we like to share it. And we like to teach it. But what happens is we become an enemy of the state because of secular humanism. We are an enemy of the state because we have this supernatural concept, this idea of God that we think should be the dominating factor in all of our lives, not just ours. What I'm not saying we're going to get stormed tomorrow and drug out and thrown into camps. I still think we're a little ways off from that. I don't know that that's never foreseeable in the future, but that's not what we're dealing with right now. I think we can be persecuted by neighbors. We can be persecuted by friends, those people who are closest to us. We have mayors and governors. We have magistrates, judges, that may tell us that we can't hold Bible studies in our homes. These are very real things that we may face in the future. These are situations that we may be placed into. There are businesses like Facebook, Twitter, Snapchat that control what can be said and what cannot be said on their platforms. We may, in a sense, be silenced. But this is the realism of understanding God's plan and continuing to produce fruits, to show exactly what we're supposed to be doing. And so how we handle ourselves now and in the future is going to play a key role and how God's able to work, what God's able to do. And so Paul ends up giving us a couple different examples in Acts. I'm going to walk through two, and then I'll give you two for examples that you can look at later on. Because Paul's fascinating, because he didn't handle every situation the same. He evaluated what he was going through. He evaluated who he was dealing with. then he used the discernment from God and say, okay, I need to do this here. He needed to do it in different manners and different ways depending on what he was dealing with. So if you look at Acts chapter 9, pick it up in verse 20. The beginning of chapter 9 talks about Paul's conversion, being struck down, receiving that wake-up call. And so shortly after, we find it here in Acts chapter 9, verse 20. Page too far. It says, immediately he preached the Christ in the synagogues that he is the Son of God. Then all who heard were amazed and said, is this not the one who destroyed those who called on the name and on this name in Jerusalem and has come here for that purpose so that he might bring them bound to the chief priests? So they still had this idea, this is the guy that was dragging Christians out and persecuting them. And now he's flipping his story. He's trying to trick us. He's like, don't fall for it. He's trying to trick us. And so he goes on. He says, but Saul increased all the more in the strength and confounded the Jews who dwelt in Damascus, proving that this Jesus is the Christ. Now, after many days were passed, the Jews plotted to kill him. But their plot became known to Saul, and they watched the gates day and night to kill him. Then the disciples took him by night and led him down through the wall in a large basket. So we get this strong message from Paul pertaining to this persecution. They didn't appreciate what he was saying. It didn't align with what they believed anymore. And so they sought to kill him. They made this plan, and what does he do? He get up in their faces and yell at them? Beat them with baseball bats? No. He got out. He slipped out the back door at night, threw a basket down the wall. He knew they were waiting for him. There's times that we have to do this. Yeah, we're expected to be prepared to give an answer. We're expected to know the truth and to be able to relay that truth to others. But at the same time, we have examples that it was best for the individuals and best for God's plan that they get out. Paul knew that God had more work for him to do, that he was supposed to be continuing on and doing something. And so he got out of the situation. He got out of the situation. And sometimes our persecution will serve a purpose, and sometimes it won't. If he'd gotten caught there and was killed on that spot, we lose a lot of history. We lose a lot of biblical history, a lot of examples of what Paul did and who Paul worked with, and the first century church. So God wasn't ready for him to die yet. And he understood that. Somehow he had the discernment that God told him that, okay, this is what you need to do. And so he got out. He got out. There's times where we face persecution that we don't always feel, well, we shouldn't always feel obligated to stand there and take it. Be persecuted. There's people out there who are just looking for fights. They're not looking to learn. They're not trying to expand what they know or knowledge. They just want to put us down. They want to persecute. And in those sense, we rely on God's Spirit to guide us and say, all right, get out. Get yourself out of this situation. And Paul recognized here that there was no benefit. It wasn't going to be a benefit to God. It wasn't going to be a benefit to him. So he got out. He removed himself from that situation. He knew that he had more work to do, and he would not have been able to do it if he didn't. This would have served zero purpose for Paul to die at this point in time. Now, God could have easily raised somebody else up and used it. We understand that. God says he can use stones, rocks, if we won't do it. But that's not the thing here. It is that there are situations in our lives where we don't want to willingly jump into persecution. We're not throwing ourselves down as martyrs. We're using discernment to try to preach the gospel to the entire world. And if we can do that in a safe way where we're protected, that's what we should choose. If you flip back just a couple chapters to Acts chapter 16 and verse 16, there's a second case. There's another example here of how Paul handles the situation. That's Acts chapter 16. We'll read 16 through 19. It says, now it happened as we went to prayer that a certain slave girl possessed with the spirit of divination met us, who brought our masters much profit by fortune telling. This girl followed Paul and us and cries out saying, These men are the servants of the Most High God, who proclaimed to us the way of salvation, and this she did for many days. So she became a nuisance here. And he says, but Paul, greatly annoyed, turned and said to the Spirit, I command you in the name of Jesus Christ to come out of her. And he came out of her that very hour. But when her masters saw that their hope of profit was gone, they seized Paul and Silas and dragged them into the marketplace to the authorities. There's persecution going on immediately. He wasn't able to get out of this one. This example gives us that he didn't back down from this situation. There was no cowering or backing off. This was a point in time where he had the discernment that he knew he was supposed to stand up for something, and he did that. He stood up in this instance. And there was immediate, intense persecution. Him and Silas were grabbed, and they were dragged through the street to the authorities. He was dragged to the authorities. And this was immediate. Now, we think about some of the persecutions that we've had, whether it was job loss or friends that don't want to talk to us anymore. All right, we can go find another job. We can work on those relationships with that friend. That's not detrimental harm to us. This was detrimental harm immediately. This is what he faced. There was a mob wanting to kill him. They were wanting to kill him. They were wanting to beat him. And so they drag him through the streets. And then right here in verse 20. Verse 20 says, and they brought them to the magistrates and said, these men being Jews exceedingly trouble our city. And they teach the customs which are not lawful for us being Romans to receive or observe. Then the multitude rose up together against them, and the magistrates tore off their clothes and commanded them to be beaten with rods. And when they had laid many stripes of them, they threw them into prison, commanding the jailer to keep them securely. Having received such a charge, he put them into the inner prison and fastened their feet in the stocks. You know, at this point, I would be very depressed. I would be pretty low. This wasn't a highlight of my day if I was drugged through the streets, beaten, and then shackled in a prison that is not like our prison system today. This is a different type of prison. It's cold, damp, dark. There's hardly any food. It's probably infested with diseases and rodents. And it's not a pleasant place. You're not getting three meals a day. You're not getting cable TV, access to internet, telephone calls. This is not what they were facing. These prisons were horrendous. And I don't know that I would be in the mindset of what we read that he does here next. Paul's reaction is pretty nice. Look at verse 25. He says, but at midnight, Paul and Silas were praying and singing hymns to God, and the prisoners were listening to them. So we get to this. They're not just singing. You know, they're not just down on their knees mumbling to themselves, praying and singing hymns just between the two of them. They're singing loud enough that this entire prison sounds like they hear what's going on. They understand what they're saying. They can hear it. Everyone's listening to what they're doing. In verse 26, he says, suddenly there was a great earthquake, so the foundations of the prison were shaken, and immediately all the doors were opened and everyone's chains were loosened. So there's this miraculous event where doors break open, chains break open, and logically, the Roman soldier who is on guard, he wakes up from his sleep, he runs in, he opens the door, he sees all the doors wide open, and he takes his knife and he's getting ready to kill himself. Roman custom was that if a Roman soldier who was in a Roman guard, if the people he was over in the prison, if the prisons that they had under their custody were escaped, that Roman guard was guilty of the penalty of that individual. And so he's getting ready to take his own life, and all of a sudden he hears, hey, don't do that. Wait just a second. Don't do that. Don't kill yourself. He said, we're all still here. We haven't gone anywhere. We're still here. And so he waits. This jailer didn't end up taking his own life. What he ends up doing, he ends up going back and he gets his whole entire family, this Roman soldier, and they all convert. They all become converted members. You know, he says, what you believe is so different, your attitude, your character is so different, you have to be right. You have to be doing something right. You have to be worshiping the right God. If you guys are atheists, you're those slanders that we have, they were atheists. If you're atheist, make me atheist. Whatever it is that you are, I want to be like you. Which is amazing. Because we think about what's happened. He probably just witnessed these men being drugged through the streets, beaten, and then thrown in jail with chains. And he goes, sign me up. I'm willing to do that. And he gets his whole family. He gets his whole family. He wanted to believe no matter what the persecution was. Because he understood that through Paul's example, that made a difference. That was the kicker. They converted. They converted because of an example. You know, this shows the influence that we can have over people. We think day in and day out, it's hard to recognize the differences that we're making in people's lives. But there's subtle changes in our attitude and character that's so different from the rest of the world that people recognize. And they understand. They may not understand today or tomorrow, but at some point they're going to understand. And we may have opportunities to work with people during the millennium that we never realized we had a connection now. That's going to be the fun thing, to try to sift through and realize that no matter what type of persecution we go through, this is the level of example that we're supposed to have. We're supposed to be that light. You know, our attitude is, we could easily get into, okay, we've seen society shift in 2020. We've seen a lot of mandates and regulations and different things that happen. We can have governors and mayors make all these rules and regulations, and we can stand here and say, oh yeah, they can say that and they can do what they want. If they come through these doors, yeah, they're going to have to deal with us. I'm not doing this. I'm not doing that. But the reality of it is, that's not how Paul acted. That's not what he did. He was the perfect example for what they needed at the time. And we're supposed to have that Christian attitude. We have to have that love and respect for God above everybody else. It doesn't matter what people do to us. We still have an expectation to God and Jesus Christ to live in a certain manner. And it's kind of how the marriages work, right? It doesn't matter what your spouse does to you. It doesn't matter how your spouse treats you. There's an expectation from God of how you're supposed to treat your spouse. That expectation doesn't change on their actions or their reactions. Just in the same sense that we have the expectations from God that we treat all of human beings as children of God. We love and we show them and we guide them. And hopefully someday He converts them. You can write down these other interactions. Acts chapter 21, verses 17 through the beginning of Acts chapter 22. Paul actually uses his Roman citizenship to his advantage. He's getting ready to go through some difficult things. He goes, hang on, I'm Roman. And so he uses the legal system. He uses the laws and the regulations to his benefit. Now, nothing wrong with that. If we can find loopholes, it's kind of like our tax system. If they build a tax system, loopholes aren't illegal. That's just part of the system. We can't look at them as illegal. So if we can use the legal system to our benefit and laws, we do that. And then Acts chapter 23. This is a funny one. Acts chapter 23, because Paul actually goes into this. He's getting persecuted by the Pharisees and the Sadducees. They're both jumping all over him. And all of a sudden, he realizes he can pit them against each other. And he goes, hang on a second. I believe in the resurrection. The thing is, with the Sadducees, they didn't believe in resurrection. They don't believe in spirit beings or angels. Where the Pharisees do believe all those things. And he goes, hang on, I believe in the resurrection. So all of a sudden, you've got the Pharisees saying, oh, we believe that too. And so he pits the two groups against each other. So instead of these two groups jumping on him and beating him up, they start beating each other up. And so he's real sly in the different tactics that he uses when he's preaching the gospel and preaching God's words. And so read through those because it's interesting to see that. You know, this persecution stuff isn't easy. It's never going to be easy. It's never going to be fun or pleasant. It's painful. It's unpleasant. And when we think about Smyrna, Smyrna is almost the forgotten church. They go through all of this turmoil. I mean, in your history of in the church, how often have you heard messages about the church at Smyrna? If it is, they're usually small. We don't spend a lot of time. Yet for decades, these people did works, they were persecuted and went through tribulations, and they were in poverty. But they were rich. But they were rich for what they did have. They didn't need all the extra glamour that was in Smyrna. They didn't need the wealth and the opportunities. And then we used Paul's example to show us how we can use different tactics, use that discernment to actually reflect who God is and how he works with us in a couple different ways. Every time that Paul did this, he showed a godly attitude. And that's not normal. That's not normal to be going through persecution and still continue to have that character. That's not normal. That's a godly attitude. And so we have that example that he's given to us of how we're supposed to react. Not to fight back. Human nature is we fight back. We don't just roll over. We don't take abuse. But that's what God has asked of us at times. We don't go searching it out. We don't go looking for it. But if there's time for trials, tribulation, persecution, we may have to stand there and be at the brunt of it. You know, Paul gave us that perfect example. He didn't destroy that idea. Smyrna, they did the same thing. They didn't let the difficulties overcome obtaining their crown. You know, in this city of massive wealth and massive glamour, they succeeded. They took God's expectations and they followed it. They experienced the tribulation, the poverty, and they had nothing, but they hung on. They hung on to the truth. They were faithful. They remained faithful so that they had that crown. So they will be resurrected as first fruits. As long as they maintain that through the rest of their life. I'm confident that these people would be first fruits. Because Jesus Christ doesn't condemn them for anything. He doesn't correct them. You know, we live in a country of massive wealth. We can relate to these people because of the blessings that God has given the United States of America, that we have blessings beyond all necessary blessings. We can look at it from that sense, that we don't know what hardship is for the most part. Most of us don't understand that lifestyle that they live. Oftentimes when people do, we have other people in the church that are able to help out and that counteract that. And we have this blessing, this benefit of being here. But that can also create a problem for us at times because, you know, we have to work now really hard to have that good character, that good attitude, the character of God, just as the members in Smyrna had. We have to do it now. We have to work on receiving our crown now, a crown of life that's going to be eternal. Because if we can't do it now, if we can't do it when things are easy, when things are good, when we have plenty, it's going to be real hard when things become a struggle. When we don't have much, when everything is stripped away, we're going to struggle. When that real persecution begins and we have poverty, if we haven't already retained that character and that attitude, it's going to be really hard to overcome that.